Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Evidence and Evidentiary Hearings Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On April 23, 2014, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in United States v. Clark. The question in this case is whether an unsupported allegation that the Internal Revenue Service issued a summons for an improper purpose entitles an opponent of the summons to an evidentiary hearing to question IRS officials about their reasons for issuing the summons. To discuss the case, we have Kristen Gutting, an associate professor of law at the Charleston School of Law. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Gutting.
The case of United States v. Clark examines the issue of when is a party that accuses the IRS of issuing a summons for an improper purpose entitled to an evidentiary hearing. The parties involved have fundamentally different perspectives on the significance of holding an evidentiary hearing at which the IRS agent issuing the summons can be questioned about her motive. For the government, the hearing is intrusive and should not be imposed on the IRS on the basis of a mere allegation of an improper purpose. For the respondents, the hearing is a very limited intrusion that must be allowed upon a plausible allegation of bad faith. In the respondents' brief, they argued, for the judiciary to fulfill its function of safeguarding against abusive summonses, it cannot be entirely dependent on one-sided submissions by the government attesting that its summons is being pursued for a proper purpose. Thus, the United States Supreme Court is confronted with determining the standard that a district court should apply in deciding if the accusing party is entitled to a limited evidentiary hearing. Let's begin with a brief overview of the IRS's power to summons and the procedure for summons enforcement. The IRS has been tasked with determining the correctness of a taxpayer's tax return. In order to accomplish this task, under Section 7602 of the Internal Revenue Code, Congress has afforded the IRS broad information gathering authority. In part, Code Section 7602 authorizes the IRS to summon the person liable for tax, any officer or employee of such person, any person having custody of books containing entries relating to the business of the person liable for tax, or any other person the IRS may deem proper. However, this authority is subject to judicial review, as a summons is not self-enforcing. Thus, if a summoned party refuses to comply, the IRS may petition the federal district court to enforce the summons. In 1964, the Supreme Court in U.S. v. Powell set forth the standard for reviewing a summons. In Powell, the Supreme Court provided that in order to establish a prima facie case that the summons is valid, the government must simply show that 1. The examination is being conducted for a legitimate purpose, 2. The information sought may be relevant to that purpose, 3. The IRS does not already possess the information being summoned, and 4. Any administrative steps required have been followed. In most cases, the IRS can satisfy this initial burden by having the investigating agent file an affidavit stating that the 4 Powell criteria have been satisfied. This is known as a Powell affidavit. Afterwards, the burden shifts to the summoned party to disprove any of the Powell elements. Additionally, the summons party has another option. The party can demonstrate that judicial enforcement of the summons would constitute an abuse of the court's process. This is a heavy burden to overcome. In Powell, the court stated that an abuse would take place if the summons had been issued for an improper purpose, such as to harass the taxpayer or put pressure on him to settle a collateral dispute, or for any purpose reflecting on the good faith of the particular investigation. To win an improper purpose challenge, the summons party must disprove the actual existence of a valid purpose by the IRS in issuing the summons. The majority view is that a district court, in its discretion, may allow the taxpayer an evidentiary hearing to substantiate her allegations that the summons was not issued in good faith. Moreover, a party challenging an IRS summons will only be entitled to an adversary hearing upon the production of some substantive evidence justifying the claim of abuse. Accordingly, most courts have not provided opponents the opportunity to question as a matter of right the IRS employee responsible for issuing the summons. Now, moving on to the facts and procedural history of Clark. In Clark, the IRS had been conducting an examination of the tax returns of Dynamo Holdings Limited Partnership for the 2005 through 2007 tax years. Generally, the IRS has 3 years from the date a return is filed to make an additional assessment. However, during the examination, Dynamo agreed to extend the statute of limitation on 2 separate occasions. Yet, in August 2010, as the extended statute of limitation was about to expire, the IRS asked Dynamo to extend the statute of limitations for a third time. Dynamo refused. It is important to note that it's common practice for the IRS to ask for an extension of the statute of limitations when the statute will expire in 180 days or less. If a taxpayer does not agree to the extension, typically, based on the facts it knows at that time, the IRS will go ahead and prepare a final partnership administrative adjustment, known as an FPAW, or a notice of deficiency, as the case may be. Soon after Dynamo's refusal to further extend the statute of limitations, the IRS issued summonses to 6 individuals associated with the partnership, but only 5 of those 6 individuals did not comply. The 5 are the respondents in the Supreme Court. The 6th individual initially refused to comply, but eventually decided to. Then, on December 8, 2010, with 3 days remaining in the statute of limitations period, the IRS issued an FPAW to the partnership. The FPAW was the original FPAW drafted and signed in August 2010. In February 2011, Dynamo challenged the IRS's FPAW in the United States Tax Court. In April 2011, 6 months after the return date for most of the summonses, the IRS sought enforcement of the unanswered summonses in the United States District Court for the Southern District of Florida. At the district court level, the respondent asserted that the IRS has an improper purpose in issuing the summonses. The respondents asserted several specific reasons, including that the summons were issued in retaliation for Dynamo refusing to extend the statute of limitations period for a third time, and that the summons were designed to circumvent the U.S. tax court's limitations on the scope of discovery. The respondent supported these allegations with evidence that they had available to them without discovery, including an affidavit from the lawyer of the 6th summons individual. The affidavit stated that the IRS interview was conducted exclusively by the 2 lawyers representing the IRS in the tax court proceeding, and that the examining agent was not even in attendance at the interview. Accordingly, the respondents requested an evidentiary hearing and pre-hearing discovery to inquire into the purpose for issuing and enforcing the summonses. Ultimately, the district court ordered enforcement of the summonses. On appeal, the 11th Circuit, in a very brief and unpublished opinion, agreed with the district court that the respondents were not entitled to a pre-hearing discovery. However, the 11th Circuit vacated the district court's order enforcing the summonses and remanded for the district court to hold a hearing. The 11th Circuit stated that a mere allegation of improper purpose is sufficient to trigger a limited hearing where the taxpayer may question the IRS officials concerning the service's reasons for issuing the summonses. The court stated that in situations such as this, requiring the taxpayer to provide factual support for an allegation of an improper purpose without giving the taxpayer a meaningful opportunity to obtain such facts saddles the taxpayer with an unreasonable circular burden, creating an impermissible catch-22. However, the court did say that the scope of any hearing in this area is left to the discretion of the district court. Thus, on remand, the respondents should be permitted to question IRS officials concerning the service's reasons for issuing the summonses. Soon after, the United States filed a petition for a writ of cert, which was granted by the Supreme Court on January 10, 2014. And on April 23rd, the United States Supreme Court heard the oral argument in the matter of Clark. The government began the oral argument by disagreeing with the 11th Circuit's holding that a district court always abuses its discretion when it denies a summons party request to examine IRS officials based on mere allegations of improper purpose. The respondents did not disagree with the government, stating that they don't defend the 11th Circuit's broad approach either. Accordingly, it quickly became clear that most of the justices viewed the 11th Circuit's minimal threshold as erroneous. In fact, Justice Scalia stated that nobody defends what the lower court said here. He later stated that we were way beyond applying the 11th Circuit's rule. Instead, the arguments focused on 2 main concerns. First, why the government wanted to enforce the summonses, and second, what type of evidence was required to trigger an entitlement to an evidentiary hearing. Early on, Justice Breyer pressed the government on the IRS's reason for pursuing the information request in the summons. While the government's attorney initially answered that the IRS wanted it to be able to revise the FPAW if the information obtained necessitated a change in the determination of the partnership's tax liability, on rebuttal, the government explained that the IRS sought the information to amend the IRS's final determination of liability for the taxpayer as part of the tax court proceeding. In response, Justice Breyer asked whether a district court could properly enforce a summons that was sought to get information that has no purpose other than to change, modify, or help the government's case in the tax court. The government did not truly answer this question, and so the government stated that while that was the reason for enforcing the summons, it was not the reason for issuing the summons. Reiterating that the improper purpose should be viewed at the time of issuing the summons, not enforcement. The government made it clear that it would be up to the tax court to decide whether or not to let evidence obtained via the summons to be used in the tax court matter. The government gave the same response when Justice Alito asked a series of hypotheticals regarding when there would be an improper purpose. This line of questioning by the justices, including Chief Justice Roberts reminding the government that the respondents had not just asserted a naked allegation, that they had support, such as an affidavit from the sixth summoned party, made it appear that the court was at least considering ruling in favor of the respondents. However, also interesting to note was that Chief Justice Roberts asked what general areas of inquiry would the respondents like to explore with the IRS agent. The respondents replied with several questions, including what role would the enforcement of the summons have in helping the IRS examination? Justice Kennedy immediately responded that it seems to him that if those are the questions that the respondents are going to ask, that almost every taxpayer's lawyer could ask those questions in almost every summons case. He said that he was now concerned it was much more to the government's position than he had originally thought with reference to the taxpayer harassing the IRS every time the IRS issues a summons. This led me to believe that the court might rule in favor of the government in order to not overburden the IRS and to clog the court with these types of cases. The discussion also focused on what type of evidence was required to trigger an entitlement to an evidentiary hearing. Justice Sotomayor asked whether the evidence required in this setting should be interpreted similarly to the evidence required in the Iqbal Twombly world, referencing two Supreme Court cases in which the court interpreted the pleading standards to require that the complaint describe facts that give rise to a plausible entitlement to relief, or to meet the higher standard of summary judgment, which requires a party to offer certain documents to support its assertion that a fact cannot be that it is genuinely disputed. The government not surprisingly answered that the higher standard of evidence found in a summary judgment should apply between the two options, that the Iqbal standard does not apply because by the time you're getting to this question about whether there's an improper purpose, the IRS would have already made a showing of proper purpose through its Powell affidavit, which raises a presumption that the government acted in good faith and with a proper purpose. However, the government did state that it did not think the summons enforcement standards exactly map onto any other civil standards like this. Instead, the government would leave the discretion to the district court to determine what process, if any, would be due in light of the allegations and inferences from the allegations. Conversely, when the respondents were asked the same question, the respondents argued that the required evidence need only meet the fact pleading standards of Iqbal. The respondents argued that if they did not have the ability to come forward with allegations that would pass muster under Iqbal and Twombly to support their allegation of improper purpose, that they would be back into the impermissible catch-22 that the 11th Circuit talked about. There would be an unreasonable circular burden because the respondents would have to have evidence to get evidence, and they can't get evidence without already having evidence. Overall, the justices seemed concerned with providing the district court guidance in determining if a hearing should be granted beyond that of simply ruling that the party would have to point to facts from which a reasonable inference of improper motive can be drawn, which could lead and has led to some courts requiring a stronger inference than others to have a hearing granted. However, the government was quick to try to relieve the justices, but possibly unsuccessful, seeing that this inference standard, with great discretion given to the district court, was the majority view and had led to little, if no, problem. In conclusion, Justice Scalia concisely stated the government's position was that there is enough evidence here to allow a district court to exercise its discretion to allow an evidentiary hearing, but not enough to reverse a district court if it did not exercise its discretion in favor of the hearing. Basically, the government's approach was to defer to the district court's discretion, even though when pressed by justices, the government admitted that based upon the facts alleged in the district court, would have had enough if to choose to order an evidentiary hearing. The government stated that the standard they advocate for this is that before a district court is actually required to allow examination of IRS officials, a summons opponent has to put into enough evidence to at least raise an inference, but agreed that circumstantial evidence would be enough. Conversely, the respondent's position was that the district court abuses discretion in denying them such a hearing, as an improper purpose could be plausibly inferred from the specific facts presented. However, the respondents would leave the district court with the discretion as to what type of hearing and what kind of evidence would be allowed to be gathered, but at a minimum suggested that there should be a chance to cross-examine the IRS employee whose Powell affidavit was supplied to justify the IRS's issue of the summonses. So how will the court rule? After listening to the oral argument, I'm not sure how the majority of justices will side. Unlike the recent tax case of Quality Stores, where anyone listening or reading the oral argument would more than likely have correctly bet that the Supreme Court's decision would come down in favor of the government, the oral arguments in Clark left a great deal of uncertainty. However, one thing was clear was that the Supreme Court's decision will not rely on the 11th Circuit's reasoning that a mere allegation of improper purpose is sufficient to trigger a limited adversary hearing. But the court did not rule out the possibility that the court would affirm on alternative grounds. So in the meantime, we will just have to wait and see on this one. The good thing is, we should not have to wait too long, as the court is expected to issue its decision by the end of June. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.